Bienvenidos, comrades, and welcome to the Jacobin Sports Show. I am your host, Matthew Miranda, joining you for episode 96. Episode 96 will feature a guest, but I like to think that there's no such thing as a guest on the Jacobin Sports Show. For when someone is a guest, they are now a friend of the pod. So today we will be welcoming friend of the pod, Karina Mustafa, who has appeared on the show before. I talked briefly to Karina about the recent RJ Barrett trade to the Toronto Raptors, mostly because as she is a Toronto-based sports writer, sports caster, and just person, I'm very interested in the Canadian reaction to RJ Barrett, who carries a weight with that demographic that he does not anywhere else. So I was interested in that, but most of our conversation actually centered on the world of tennis. In particular, some of the points that were raised in an article by a man named Matthew Futterman at The Athletic. The article was titled, "Professional Tennis is Broken. Here's How to Fix It." I'm not a hardcore tennis fan. I'm very casual. I like the majors. I'll watch like finals especially, but I'm not someone who's going to watch Indian Wells or, you know, even the finals at the end. Like I just watch Grand Slams. I'm a casual. So as I talked to Karina about, I had this assumption from the outside that pro tennis is just circadian rhythm of stability and organization, and it's not. There's a lot of weird things in professional tennis, some of which Futterman talked about, a lot of which Karina raised on her own, particularly from a labor perspective, brought up some realities that tennis players deal with that I was not familiar with at all. I'm going to see if I can get Matthew Futterman on in the future. Whether you like tennis or not, it's just a fascinating conversation. The way that tennis is structured and fragmented, and some of the tensions going on, especially now as in golf and soccer with more Saudi Arabian money coming in. Very, very interesting. So even if you're not a crazy tennis fan, it's very worth hearing the conversation. That's going to come after my little solo bit here. So stay tuned for Karina. I'm just going to talk about a few little things that have crossed my radar that I want to share with you. One of which, there's no theme to them really. They're just a handful of, hey, did you know? So, hey, did you know that in Oakland, California, where the professional Major League Baseball team, and I use the word professional very lightly, the Oakland Athletics are going to be leaving after next season. They've been in Oakland since, I think, 1968, but they're going out to Las Vegas despite really, really, really just brilliant fans and hardcore public mobilization against it and a lot of like really beautiful human organization. But the A's are going because they think they can make more money in Las Vegas. So there's a league out in the Rockies and west of there called the Pioneer League. It's a semi-pro league. Not a semi-pro league. It's a professional league. I think it has some affiliation with the major leagues, but it's like if you live on the East Coast and you know the Long Island Ducks, they play like in a pro league, but it's not the minor leagues. But it's a good league. So there's a team in it called the Oakland Ballers, and the Oakland Ballers founders were working this year with a group called ASM Global. ASM Global is the organization that is responsible for managing the Coliseum, which is where the Oakland A's play baseball and where there's concerts and events and things. So with the A's leaving, especially, the Oakland Ballers thought, hey, wouldn't it be nice if we had some kind of an event to celebrate baseball in the city of Oakland, given that we're about to lose a team that we've had here for over half a century. So they were going to launch a new team, and then they had signed an agreement with ASM Global to host a game at the Coliseum next June. Literally days before this was going to be announced, the Oakland A's, who remember are leaving in a year, despite everyone begging them to stay, the Oakland A's invoked their legal right as the current tenant of the Coliseum to block this event from taking place. So literally, this is like something out of The Grinch, or you're robbing a city of its 55-year-old baseball love. Shortly after, remember, the Golden State Warriors have now left Oakland to play in their palace in San Francisco. The Raiders left Oakland, who are now in Las Vegas. Oakland just loses team after team after team. And here you have a couple of people saying, all right, let's have an event just to celebrate. It doesn't have to be about the A's. It doesn't have to be about the Major League Baseball. Like, let's just celebrate baseball in Oakland. And people will come out and we'll have a good time with it. And the fucking A's are like, no. And according to A's Vice President of Stadium Operations, David Rinetti, and this is the most just 1% capitalist logic. This was the A's Vice President of Stadium Operations' response to why the A's invoked their right to block this event from taking place. Quote, "We have the exclusive right to play professional baseball at the Coliseum, and we therefore do not consent to the request." Like, oh my God, fuck you. You know, cognitively, like, there's no such thing as enough, and that's what's killing the planet. Because there's a group of people for whom there is no such thing as enough. They've taken an abstract concept and run with it to literally, like, suicidal, genocidal, civilization-wide levels. You understand that that's what's happening. But to see it, like, even in a little... You have the right, you have a legal right on paper to deny someone the right to play baseball at the Coliseum, probably because legally you wanted to be protected against, you know, Team X shows up from Planet Y and offers the Coliseum $1 trillion to play, and suddenly you're out on your ass. But, like, that's not a threat. That's not going to happen. You have a right to something that there's no legitimate concern over. Of course you have the exclusive right to play pro ball at the Coliseum. You're the Major League Baseball team in that city. You're going to play wherever you would like to. You would be playing in a new stadium by now if you wanted to be in one in Oakland. But the logic of, well, we have the right to say no, therefore we say no, just takes me back to childhood and, like, the boiling rage of, like, hearing "because I said so." That's really what this is. It's "because I said so." But at least, like, I think when I look now and realize that my parents were probably exasperated from having to explain everything to my litigious ass when I was like 14, this is not that kind of "because I said so." This is like if my father said "because I said so," stuck his middle finger right in front of my face, and then punched me in the dick. That's what this is like. Doesn't have to be that way, but that's how this is like. And if you thought that was the only sad baseball story of the relatively new year, oh no. Because we were also subjected recently to former Dodger and Red pitcher Trevor Bauer appearing in an interview with Fox, because Bauer has settled out of court. This was his first time speaking, I believe, publicly, since he settled with a woman who had accused him in 2021 of... battery and sexual assault. Bauer played last year in Japan, and now he wants to play in the U.S., and he's decided that it's all good. Everything is good. And he showed up on Fox with a haircut, and he's wearing a suit and a tie, which first tells you, like, if you don't know anything about Trevor Bauer, this is the first thing you have to know about Trevor Bauer, is that he's the kind of person in 2024 who thinks that a haircut and a suit and a tie means something positive. Like, and if you read his quotes, so he was talking about where he stands now as to when all of this started. And he said, quote, "I know I've made mistakes. That's kind of what I'm trying to focus on. How do I get better from the experiences that I've had? I've made mistakes in my personal life. I'm really detail oriented when it comes to baseball and my training, but I didn't apply the same level of scrutiny to my personal life. So I'm a little already now like, this doesn't sound like you've learned anything, because when the athlete resorts to, you know, this is a lot like sports, and you're is justified, because then he says, quote, "I made mistakes. I agreed to do things I shouldn't have done. I was reckless. It hurt a lot of people along the way. I made things very difficult for," here comes the list, "Major League Baseball, for the Dodgers, my teammates, my friends, family, people close to me. So I've done a lot of reflecting on that and made a lot of changes in my life to address that. And here, dear listeners, is the quote of the year. I don't care what anyone says in the next 51 weeks. We have already hit the peak quote of 2024. Care of Trevor Bauer, explaining here why how he's learned from what's happened. And after saying I've done a lot of reflecting and made a lot of changes in my life to address that, he says, quote, "I'm not having casual sexual relationships anymore, for example." So, not to get into anyone's business and not to be too, you know, up on Main Street with mine, but I have had casual sexual relationships. I'm sure a lot of you have as well. Some of you listening may even be famous professional athletes who have had casual sexual relationships. There's at least the theoretical possibility that someone listening to this pod right now is a famous professional athlete who has engaged in casual sexual relationships that involve the use of very aggressive, violent behavior between consenting adults. And yet, none of us have recently settled with a woman out of court because of multiple charges of sexual battery and assault. The problem, Trevor Bauer, is not that you had casual sex. My God. He comes out of all this and his takeaway is that, you know what? If this had all happened in the sanctity of a Christian marriage where we only procreate to have babies, I'd be fine. That's his takeaway from all this. And then he says, quote, I've grown up a lot for sure. My viewpoints now are drastically different than they were 5 years ago, 10 years ago. Motherfucker, you were charged with this 3 years ago. Talk about 3 years ago. He apologizes first to Major League Baseball, then to the Dodgers, then to his teammates. None of those people accused you of sexual assault. I try to include a balance of stories here, and I promise you that the Krina interview is very bright and positive and I think like pleasant to listen to. So I'm really trying to make sure I guard against all stories being negative. And the last, there's one at least after this that's not negative, but I'm going to give you one more complaint. I'm sorry. this might be where the show is headed with its new title, which I will reveal in episode 100. But out of the NBA, this wasn't really something that happened so much as there was a piece in The Guardian that was looking into how the notion of privacy and what's public and what isn't has changed for NBA athletes over the years. So it's actually a very good article. I'm afraid I can't think now of who wrote it, but if you look up The Guardian NBA privacy, it'll be there. And they made a point how like Michael Jordan at the peak of his fame in 1992, between playoff games against the Knicks in New York, so you have all the media you could possibly have focusing on this series, Michael Jordan could gamble until 4 or 5 in the morning and play golf all day between games, and nobody knew it. Like, as crazy much as there was, like, a microscope on Jordan then, even relative to now, like, it's bizarre that he could do that. That year in the Summer Olympics, the article mentions, when Charles Barkley, who was the leading scorer and the leading personality on that dream team, that famous, famous Michael Jordan, that dream team, Charles Barkley walked around Barcelona with no security and he was fine. Like he was totally, totally cool. There were stories from the videos of the dream team have talked about. They were somewhere where the bus was stuck in traffic and John Stockton literally just got off the bus with his family because he realized he would get to the arena quicker if they just walked there. And like nobody, he was totally fine doing it. So the article is a good read if you want to be like, oh, things are very different. But Garrett Temple raised the Draymond Green Jordan Poole video, and he raised it in a way that I think is speaks fundamentally to my concern about, I don't know how to even phrase this. Here's the deal. So in this article being asked about privacy and social, they always call it social media culture, like it's not everybody. And Garrett Temple was referencing the fact that if you remember when the Draymond video leaked of him punching Jordan Poole out of practice, the Warriors were very upset, really upset right off the bat, not about the assault, but about the video leaking. And Temple here, who's now with the Players Association. He was a 14-year pro. Garrett Temple said, quote, you think about big situations. The Poole video was something that just should not get out because it was so disturbing. That's just the league we live in now. There's this really creepy Orwellian lack of trust in our ability to be adults to me when you talk about like of all the things that happen in reality, of all the things that people deal with, whether in the comfort of this country relative to others, if you just want to focus on first world problems and shit, the idea that, like, the NBA wishes this video hadn't gotten out because it's just so disturbing and we just care so much about the fans. But hey, that's just the league we live in now. Well, it was disturbing. It was someone being violently assaulted in a space where they're supposed to be safe, surrounded by coworkers. There's videotape happening. Like, you have reason to presume that, like, I think I'm safe here, but if something really just fucked up happens, at least I also know, like, there's a camera on. And their whole anger when this happened was about the fact Ramona Shelburne, in the same I think it was the same Guardian piece, talked about was quoted talking about this effect that the leak had on the Warriors. If you remember, they were the defending champions when they came back and had this event happen before the season started. Shelburne said on Zach Lowe's pod, quote, "Even when you bring it up now, people are really angry about the leak. That shattered the mystique of trust that had always been there with the Warriors. I don't think anything is ever the same since the leak." And this is going to tie into the next story I want to talk about, but it's really important to think about what is being centered as the subject and the object, and how that perspective really kind of reveals what is of import here. Whistleblowers are never the problem. Whistleblowers are heroes. Whistleblowers have legal protections, ideally, because what they do is so difficult and dangerous and rare. If a lot more people were a lot more public about a lot more problems, we wouldn't need whistleblowers. The word wouldn't even exist. But it does. Even in a legal context, the word exists because we need it to, because there's that much stuff going on around that's messed up that is being allowed to flourish. The issue is not the leak. The subject is not the leak. The subject of this story is not even the punch. When Temple talks about this is the world we live in, it is the world we live in. It's not the world we live in now. And when you talk about the Warriors and you're talking about culture and mystique, that's a lot of ornamentation and fog to just cover the fact that that culture boiled down in the end to only the bottom line matters, which is not a revolutionary culture at all. That's capitalism. The Warriors made it look beautiful, very, very pretty. Put a nice, can't have a better face on it than Steph, a better game on it than Steph. Steve Kerr can be very articulate and passionate about issues outside of sports, which is always welcome. But Draymond Green for 8 to 10 years has been doing the same thing. Whether you want to go back to LeBron in the finals in 2016, whether you want to go back to Steven Adams and the various testicular assaults that Green unleashed on him, there's a whole internet full of all of it. But Golden State has consistently revealed, they revealed it in particular after the assault happened. What was the company's response to one coworker violently assaulting another one in a safe workspace? They didn't fire the assailant. They didn't move the assailant out. They didn't even suspend the assailant. They had him go think about it for a few days. By the end of the season, they rewarded the assailant with a contract extension and got rid of the victim. And the reason why nobody blinks when you see that is because, of course, we understand. Of course they gave Draymond an extension. And of course they traded Poole. Draymond is essential to their ability to win a title. On offense and on defense, he is irreplaceable. There is not a person in the league who can do everything that he can do. Jordan Poole, he didn't have a good season. Of course they made this move because only the bottom line matters. So when the NBA, Temple, etc., don't talk about how, well, sadly, this is the world we live in and we're just trying to protect our fans from it. Your fans are the people who live in this world. And you people are the reason mostly that it's this way. Speaking of subject versus object, I always enjoy being able to defend Kyrie Irving, and this is going to be one of those moments. And this gets to the question of, is it appropriate for a private individual to enter a public individual's workplace to question something that that public individual said on their private social media? If I've given you enough adjectives, here is the story. Kyrie Irving, who plays now for Dallas, was playing in a game with the Mavericks in Utah. And there's a man named Avrami Zippel, a Jewish man, I think he's from New York, who was really affected a couple years ago by, if you remember, Kyrie on his Instagram linked to a video or a series of videos that, it was one like long video that included in it links and references to anti-Semitic just grossness. And there was a whole big hullabaloo at the time about it. So Avrami Zippel went with his father, his brother, and his brother-in-law to the game in Utah. And they each had a sign that they were holding, that on the sign, it was a blue and white sign, and it said, "I'm a Jew and I'm proud," and it had Star David on it. They held the signs in the court before the game, got a photo. They held the signs in front of arena security as the game began, no issues. In the first quarter, Irving was about to inbound the ball, near where this group of Zippel and his family was. Irving saw the sign, and according to Zippel, he said, quote, "Nice, I'm Jewish too." And Zippel says that he said, Zippel, quote, "Cool, happy new year, buddy." And then Zippel says that after Kyrie inbounded the ball and started to go up the court, he called back over his shoulder to Zippel, "Don't got to bring a sign like that to a game." There's like no story here. Like, Zippel wanted to make a point, I think, and be seen, and he was. Kyrie didn't need to touch it at all. Had a nice exchange. Expressed an idea. But nobody can trust that there's adults. So a few minutes later, Zippel is asked to remove the signs from courtside. The Jazz, in a statement, this is all from a piece in The Athletic, quote, "The Jazz said the signs were removed because they interfered with the play of the game and that the team had no issue with the message on the signs. The issue was the disruptive interaction caused by the usage of the signs, the team said in a statement, not the content of the signs." Which is interesting. Maybe every team has its own rules of conduct. The NBA, as far as code of conduct for guidelines for signs, the only guideline is size-wise. It can't be bigger than 11 by 17 inches. It doesn't say anything about content. So this is not a big story, other than I don't have an answer. I'm just honestly curious if a Kyrie Irving published something a few years, maybe 2 years ago, maybe, on his private social media, but he's obviously not a private individual in the sense that he has millions and millions of followers. So that's why I called him a public individual, even though he is private. For Zippel to come to Kyrie's workplace with the intention of getting some kind of a reaction or response, clearly, about that statement, it's a little, I'm curious, like, is it cool that Kyrie has to, that Guardian piece featured a lot of Kevin Durant also, I think, talking about just this assumption that people have that, like, now today we just assume you have a right because everything is so accessible. You just have this expectation to, like, Kyrie said this on his Instagram, I don't like it. I'm going to go to a game and I'm going to hold a sign up and I want Kyrie to respond. That's kind of a weird thing to do. Especially, I think in this case, like, you traveled, you got on a plane and you flew somewhere to try to get Kyrie Irving to react to your reaction to something that he posted to. And I'm not settled on this. I don't know if, like, okay, like, nothing bad happened. There was no violence or threats of anything. Two people exchanged a couple sentences. That was it. Like, that's how ideas are exchanged, maybe. Like, I don't know if there's anything weird about it or not, but just something. I don't know. I guess I'm just saying, I think that's interesting, and I hope you do. And I hope it gave you something to think about. Last little bit of sports news before we get to the Krina interview. This week, history occurred in the NBA. The Oklahoma City Thunder became the first team in league history to win 23 of their first 33 games while continuing to start a player who is being investigated for raping a minor, with weeks having passed since the charges first arose, and still neither the player nor the team has been able once to say, no, that didn't happen. He's not a rapist. Fingers crossed that we get to that day someday, but there's been a lot of hype and hullabaloo around the Thunder this week because they won a very impressive game against the Celtics. I don't have the standard for how anyone else should behave or think. And sometimes it's different in one medium to another, sports versus acting versus music. I have no idea how to triangulate what is right and what is wrong, but I can't look at a team on the floor and see a 20-something year old millionaire and know that, like, a couple months ago he was probably raping a minor, and I'm just supposed to focus on what a great game. Like, I'm not judging. If you enjoy the game, if you don't care, if you feel like until there's news there's nothing to talk about, I get it. But it's just hard sometimes to be like, oh, we're doing this again. Like, okay, it's a different year, but we're doing this again. Okay. So that's it for this portion of the episode. Please stay tuned for the interview with Krina Mustafa. Remember, as always, to follow us on Twitter if you don't, at Jackman Sports. I don't know why I keep reading that. Follow me on Twitter at Matthew E. Miranda, because I don't really check the Jackman page nearly as much as I used to. You can email jackmansports@gmail.com with any thoughts, suggestions, anything at all that you'd like to have heard. If you want to say it, I will hear it. As you know, it's a new year in 2024. That gives you a new chance to subscribe to our Patreon, which I am hilariously currently unable to log into. Apparently, I must have just gone long enough without checking it. I usually check it like every month. Apparently, I cannot now get back into it. So I hope you're there, and I hope to join you there soon. That is all for this part of my episode. Wow. That is all for this part of my part of the episode. Please stay tuned for Krina Mustafa next. Peace, comrades. So today's guest is friend of the pod, Krina Mustafa. Krina has been here before. She is currently the host of the Coast to Coast podcast for Her Hoop Stats. But you can always find Krina somewhere, writing or on your screen or on your audio. She is all over the place doing everything. Krina, nice to have you back. Welcome to the Jackman Sports Show again. How are you doing?
Thank you so much for having me back. I'm good. Just kind of on the tail end of the holiday season. My winter semester is around the corner, so just trying to enjoy a little bit of a break before it gets busy again.
There is no time in life than like between a fall and spring semester when you're just trying to like get the life and the compression and the break and the everything in. I know what you mean, and I wish you well with it, as always. Krina, the first time you were on the Jackman Sports Show, you detailed a long and personal history. You talk a lot about basketball and cover a lot of basketball, but tennis is a sport that goes back, like, I think even longer with you in your life. And so I want to open by asking you about basketball instead, and specifically by misdirecting to the recent trade that is an enormous story in New York, but I think also an enormous story, not just for the Raptors, but for kind of Canada basketball as a whole, which is, of course, the trade that sent OG Anunoby and other players to the Knicks and brought back Emmanuel Quickly, but in particular RJ Barrett to the Raptors. So first, I'm just curious, like, RJ Barrett is just an extremely likable human being. Like, he's just always been liked. I know someone who taught him apparently in like eighth grade or something there and said he's like the sweetest kid. Like, RJ Barrett is just loved. But he's known in New York as, like, he's the son of Rowan Barrett, who went to St. John's, and like, so there's some affiliation there, but he is royalty in Canada. Is it, like, we keep hearing here, like, oh, they got RJ Barrett back. Like, that's a bigger move than just a basketball move. Is it a big deal that RJ Barrett is back and now playing for the Canadian team near where he grew up?
I will say this, because I was very much an OG Anunoby appreciator. I grew like a very big attachment to him as a player over his like seven seasons in Toronto or whatever it was. So I was with my boyfriend, Mark Schindler, and he's the one who saw the trade at first, and he was like, OG Anunoby just got traded. And I was like, what? I just whipped my head around. I was like, there's no way. And he's like, yeah, the Raptors are getting RJ Barrett and Emmanuel Quickly. And I was like, I couldn't even process. I was just like in a state of shock. I could not believe A, that the Raptors even did a move like that, because they have been so quiet the last couple of years. They haven't really made a lot of big moves. And aside from like maybe a couple, like the getting Jakob Poeltl back or things like that, but like really something of this caliber hasn't happened in a while. So I think my first initial feeling was shock. And then I think like I'll be okay with like letting OG go eventually. I do have to admit that there are some sentiments there, but I think getting RJ Barrett is pretty cool. It's pretty awesome. You could see like just how much he was happy to be home. You speak of, you knew somebody who taught him. Like I knew somebody who was his prom date. So like there's a lot of different connections here.
RJ Barrett is a popular man.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think like, yeah, from what you said, like he seems like a really good guy, and really he's a really good basketball player too. I think this is going to end up being good for the Raptors. The Raptors are in a bit of a weird spot, and I think ultimately they were going to have to do something to shake things up. I think you're also not going to be able to find another player like OG, which is part of why I'm just so like, I was so hesitant on letting him go, because he's such a unique style of player. And but at the same time, like getting both RJ Barrett and Emmanuel Quickly back in that, I think was huge, especially if the Raptors want to just try to get back to being a little bit more competitive, because they did not start the year out that great. So I think overall this is good. I think also the attention that this is getting over like the Canadian significance too, I think is awesome. Like coincidentally, I'm starting an internship with Canada Basketball in about a week.
Congratulations.
Thank you. So this is great. I mean, it's like everything is on the up and coming for Canada Basketball. Right. I'm sure I'm going to be around this story a lot in the next couple of months. So I'm excited to see his fit. I mean, already he's started to play well for the Raptors in just his first game. So I think all in all, it's pretty cool, especially when a player wants to be in Toronto and wants to be home, and you can tell that they're like super happy to be there.
Yeah. I think it's hard for him to leave New York. And he said that like he really enjoyed, for the time he first got to New York, he made a thing about it. But I think anybody who cares for him is like happy that if he had to go anywhere, like this was absolutely the place that would appreciate him the most. And I think it's such a good fit for, I think, him and Quickly, both basketball-wise, are going to be in better, Quickly especially, will be in a better position than he was in New York. And I think Barrett also will be, because you have to assume the Raptors are not going to stop just with this trade. Like, there's probably more. And like you said, like, they've been, I mean, people have been waiting for years for the Raptors to do something. There was no smoke that, like, it was suddenly. I was shocked when I first came across my screen. I misread it. I was like, no, that sounds like a trade, and there's no way there was a trade. And then when I saw it was Anunoby in Toronto, I was like, no, because they don't make trades. Like, I had to go back really and like, oh, this happened. Oh,
yeah.
It's like the biggest Knick trade in 5 years too. This is a big deal.
It was quite the New Year's surprise. That was another thing too, I think, that added to the shock, even for the players too. Like, it was literally like New Year's Eve. Like, I just, oh.
I know. I kept thinking about it. I kept thinking about OG, because I was like, my heart broke for like thinking about a person, like you have to leave your whole life. Now you're in a new place on New Year's Eve. Maybe you have nowhere to go. I'm sure he does, but like I just pictured OG and he'd be like alone in this empty apartment with boxes. With
oh
like
God,
on New Year's Eve. So on to brighter stuff. I think we'll talk now about tennis, and I'm going to confess to my tennis casualness, because most of the sports that we talk about on the Jackman Sports Show, if it's basketball or soccer or baseball, like I'm pretty into it. But and like tennis, I think tennis goes back a long way for me, like, but in a casual sense. Like, I follow the Grand Slam since I was young, and I'm old enough that like I watched, like, I go back to like Yvonne Lendl and when Navratilova and Everett were like in their late stage and Monica Seles was the baby. Like, I have followed the Grand Slams for like years. And if you follow from that casual distance, tennis seems like the most stable, like grounded. You can set your watch to tennis of all things in the world. And then there was this article this week in The Athletic. Not this week, sorry. It came, oh, it was December 20th.
Last week.
Last week, by Matthew Futterman, titled Professional Tennis is Broken, Here's How to Fix It. And I was first drawn to it, just the headline got me, and I was like, The Athletic is not a hotbed of sensationalism, but I was like, okay. like tennis isn't broken. Like, obviously, like, let me quickly find the flaw with this. And I started reading and came to learn that, like, there's a whole violent ecosystem of weirdness in tennis, just in the governance and the structure and everything, that is a casual who just, it's Wimbledon Sunday. Like, you have no idea. I literally took notes. I have notes on,
that's
like,
incredible.
I had to take, because, like, I felt like I was learning, like, a new language or something. Like, so I have questions, like, specific questions for you about tennis, but I also have just, I am a wide open canvas right now of curiosity. So, first, I'm curious, one of Futterman's contentions in his piece is that one of the reasons there's a lot of kind of new activity happening in tennis and different parties that are trying to seemingly land on a new approach to the structure is actually started with the Saudi Arabian entrance into golf through LIV Golf, and how in the world of golf, when this massive new outside force backed by endless money proposed an alternative, like, it gave a lot of players obviously the opportunity that did not exist when you're in a one company sport. That's it. If you want to play professional golf and you're in the US, it's the PGA, but now there was suddenly an alternative. And in this article, he talks about how, well, basically either the fear of that or has there been an outside gesture made by the Saudis to start their own tennis league, or is this just something that's in the ether that is causing the WTA and other groups to, like, maybe start to think about how, if it could happen?
So there's a lot of different things here with Saudi Arabia. One of the first things they tried to do actually was host the WTA finals this past year, I should say, in 2023. However, there was a lot of controversy surrounding that, just because of the country itself and the ideas and laws that they have against, like, LGBTQ plus
people. Do they want the men's and the women's tournaments?
Yeah, so this one specifically was for the women's finals.
Okay.
And that's what they originally wanted to be the host site for it. But the issue is, a lot of the players are part of the LGBTQ plus community, and they have voiced that they are not really comfortable playing somewhere like that. And there was a lot of... there was a lot of, like, backlash, and then they ultimately ended up choosing Cancun in 2023. And then there's even more backlash because it was all very much rushed and put together in the last, like, literal weeks before the tournament started. And this is supposed to be, like, the biggest, technically this is the biggest tournament of the year. It's like the NBA or WNBA finals, but for tennis. And it's like the top eight players in the world, based on that specific year, based on how many points they've accumulated in their rankings, face off together, and the person who wins is, like, the biggest trophy of the year. And so there was already a bit of controversy about that. And then this news came out about, like, the new tennis league and how they want to make it into some sort of Premier League. And I think, so this has been kind of rumblings of this for a little bit now, and I think it's starting to get a little bit real, based on things that I've heard as well too. It sounds like this might be the direction that tennis is going in. What do I think that that's a good thing? Not necessarily overall. I think I do agree with, I don't know if I would say tennis, professional tennis is broken. I think that's a very exaggerated statement. However, I think there are a lot of areas that need to improve. And I know that one of the main points in the article was that there's, like, the Grand Slams are fighting against, like, the smaller tournaments, and there's, like, just too much separate stuff going on. But I think that if you introduce this Premier League, would that not separate things even more? Like, that's kind of where my head was at. So I'm kind of, like, iffy about it, if I had to choose a word right now.
Yeah, there's something odd about the idea that we have to change things because there's a separate but unequal balance between the Grand Slams and the others. So we're going to accomplish that by completely separating them into two different competitions. Like, that's one of the things being discussed. I'm curious about tennis and labor, and something that I did not know until I read Futterman's article, which was that in professional tennis, the revenue share, players make about 25% of the revenues in professional tennis versus in most other sports. Like, I always hate in the NBA, but the NBA players in my lifetime have had that share gradually cut down. It used to be around 57%, and the owners have, like, really whittled it down to about 50%, and I always think it should be, like, more. But in tennis, I was stunned to see that it's only 25%. And my question about tennis, because I was reading about this group that the PTPA, that I guess Djokovic is maybe behind. Is there, first of all, do men's and women's tennis function separately as like labor organizations? Like, is it like the WNBA and the NBA where like they have two different unions?
So they do not. So that is the biggest thing with tennis. The biggest difference is that all tennis players are independent contractors. They do not. The ATP and WTA, there's no union. That's why this like players association thing is relatively new. They are actually not, like, there is no union. There's no CBA. There's no negotiations or anything like that. So that's like one of the biggest things that separates tennis from like those like team sports, like basketball, like hockey, et cetera. So that's the reason why that percentage might seem low, where also in actuality, like if you're at the top of tennis, you are making a lot of money, but there are also still a lot of issues there, but that is because the players are independent contractors. So they cannot really negotiate for like a base salary or anything like that. That's another problem too, because it's like, you only get money if you win. And that's why players have these crazy calendars, which I think was like, according to that article too, I think that's the key issue in tennis right now, especially with the complaints that you've been hearing from the players, is like the calendar is too long and there's so many tournaments that players have to go, or else like they're not going to make a living, especially if you're like in the middle of the pack or even just entering, because tennis players have to pay for their coaching staff. They have to pay for like all the physicals, like everything they have to do, including their own travels. Like that comes from the earnings they get from winning, and you have to play matches and win them in order to get money. And for a lot, and there's another issue too, like the women are still getting paid less than the men. That's like a whole other thing that now the tours have started to implement, equal pay by 2033, which is another thing where they have announced all these changes in the tournaments. So there are different levels of tournaments. You have like 125, 250, 500s, then the 1000s, and then the Grand Slams. And so there's like a certain level of money at each one. And so they announced that some tournaments in the calendar are getting upgrades. Some aren't getting upgraded. They're getting demoted, things like that. They're changing things around so that it becomes a little bit more equal, and that the women start to earn the same as the men do at each of these tournaments, which is why, because they've implemented these like till 2033, as well as some tournaments in Canada too, like the one in Canada that they play in Toronto and Montreal, that's going to get equal pay by like 2025. And they're expanding that tournament to like 2 weeks.
Nice.
So that kind of stuff makes me wonder, well, if the Premier League is going to come in, how does that affect all of these initiatives that are starting to be implemented in order to achieve that equal pay? Because that's also going to shake up the calendar.
One of the, I guess, questions behind your question that also I had not understood until I read Futterman's article was that tennis, unlike all these other sports, has this really fragmented kind of family of governing bodies, rather than, like, from outside, I thought, oh, WTA must, they run tennis, and or you have some vague, I don't even know, there's a WTA and an ATP, and I never put together that those are two different, like, is this to who?
There's so many different governing bodies. It's like the WTA is like the Women's Tennis Association, the ATP is the men, but then you also have like the ITF circuit, which is for like the more college levels, just a little bit, it's like right under the pro. It's still, they're still considered pro tours, but they're just under that 125 level tournament that I was talking about earlier. So you'll get a lot of like 60K tournaments where like if you win, you win $60,000. Like that's kind of how they're set up. And usually those up and coming players are the ones that are playing those tournaments, or you get players who had cracked a certain ranking in the WTA or ATP, then had an injury or something that had them out for a long time, and then to be able to get back into the pro level tours, they play on the ITF circuit, and like a lot of college players do that too. And then you have also like the Billie Jean King Cup and the Davis Cup and all these like international competitions in addition to like, and the Olympics, which are going to be this year too, which all of the, there's so many different governing bodies that have a say into the calendar, which is part of the reason why the calendar is such a mess.
Yep.
Which is why I'm confused about like the Premier League, like, okay, we're going to introduce that. I feel like that's going to cause even more chaos.
The only sport that I follow that has like multiple governing bodies and agendas is soccer. And soccer has grown to the point now that a lot of the top managers, Pep Guardiola's talked about it, Jurgen Klopp, a lot of the top players have too. They find the fixture calendar is just too congested. And they just keep adding, FIFA keeps adding tournaments and expanding tournaments. And the players keep saying, like, there's a breaking point. Like, we can't, like, do this. So I imagine in tennis having even more bodies, even more agendas, having individuals functioning as independent contractors. There was a lot of things reading in Futterman's article that kind of exposed to me how much I didn't know professional tennis players as individuals bear so much more of the burden for just trying to keep their career going as other athletes do in other sports. Like you were saying, how they have to pay for their own travel, their own, everything. And there was he referenced, and when you talked about the congested calendar and how there's like 11 months, I think now, of like tournaments, and there was reference to the story of a player named Alina Svitolina, who was referenced as basically having a baby kind of gave her a competitive, eventually gave her some kind of a competitive advantage, and that she was able to practice for 2 months straight, and that there's absolutely no time for players to practice during the season. There's something insane about following every sport and understanding the value of practice and understanding that in this one, you have these, the top people in the world frantically trying to like just keep themselves eligible to run from tournament to tournament. And they can't even like work on their craft because the lack of a cohesive governance, like it's the most, I think it's for me, just in pure athletic, like tennis is beautiful. Like just the idea of one person and like what they're doing and the endurance that it requires. Like, there's a reason why even in a casual distance, like I've probably watched tennis longer than almost any sport. Cause when you're a kid, you can sit and watch it and you get it. It's simple. Like the simplicity is beautiful, but the more you learn about everything in the game and now you learn the more about the madness off of it. And you're just like, how does anyone get anything done in the world of tennis?
And I could even go into so many other layers, like the types of balls that tournaments are using, the courts are different.
What's the deal with the types of balls?
So this year, for the first time, so what happened was the men and the women used to have different kinds of balls. The men had the heavier ones because like they hit harder, they're bigger. The women had the lighter ones. There was a whole fuss about that. And this year, for the first time during the hard court swing in the summer, the women got the heavier balls as well. However, what had happened was the players were starting to get injured because the balls were so hard to hit because of how heavy they were. And they were changing from tournament to tournament. So some tournaments had the heavier balls, some tournaments had the lighter balls, and then some courts were like the faster courts and some were the slower courts, even though they were all supposed to be hard court. And that's already because every tournament does things the way that they want to do it, especially between the different levels. Like the court at the US Open is different than the court in Toronto or Montreal. And already players were complaining about that, as well as even the schedule. Like I worked the tournament in Montreal this year, and I am one person who works one tournament minimum a year for 1 week, and I'm exhausted, and I can't even imagine picking myself up next week, traveling, flying somewhere else to do it all again. Like it's crazy how much of a toll everything is. Like it's, players are constantly in a state of change. Like whether it is something as the type of ball to like the place that they're going to, like things like jet lag aren't even considered. Like there's such a tight turnaround, and they have started to implement, like they have some rules when it comes to like if a player ends up making it to like the semifinals or more than that in a tournament, they're like given a bye into the next round of the next tournament that they're playing into. But like still, that's only like 1 or 2 days break. And that's just so that they can end up traveling. And it's just a whole mess, honestly.
Do you see any evidence that like, does this PTPA group, is there any signs that either the players are organizing better for their collective interest, or that the bodies are consolidated? Like, is this business as usual and it's just going on continuing, or is there any indication that like maybe something positive is happening?
I can't say that I've seen anything substantial come from this Players Association yet. I mean, we saw like the WTA, the head, I think Steve Simon or whoever, was like refusing to even be in the room with them while negotiating something. And even during like when there was the pandemic and they were trying to figure out how to play tennis in like empty stadiums and just that whole mess, like they kind of got in the way too, honestly, and because of like different beliefs and things like that too. And so I haven't seen, it's really tough because it isn't really a union, so it's just kind of hard to figure out where they come in and how they can actually help. I think, I don't know if like we just need to start over. I think that's just very difficult to do at this point in tennis, but I think the main thing, the main problem is that because all the tournaments are kind of going against each other, and like even the Grand Slams don't even agree within each other on different rules in the tournaments. Like they have different, they have different rules on like what type of tiebreak you're supposed to play in the last set at each Grand Slam. Like it's different. Some Grand Slams do you play to 10 points in the last tiebreak. Some Grand Slams do you have to do the win by two games, and then they, those just go on forever. Like, it takes them so long to agree on something as minuscule as that. And that's why I just find it very hard to believe that they could agree on something like a calendar or the types of courts being used, the types of balls. And I think we have to get to a point where instead of continuing to separate things, it does need to come a little bit together so that we can actually construct a calendar where if there are less tournaments, fine. However, make it so that there's an equal number of each level of tournament so that players aren't like sacrificing one for the other and then end up sacrificing their bodies in the end and even their mental. Like there's so many different factors here.
So I'm going to guess Futterman wrote one of the points that he touched on was this seeming question of point about different agendas or relevance of the Grand Slams versus the other tournaments. And I was going to ask you if you thought that one is any more essential than the other, but I'm guessing your answer would be that there's room for both, just room maybe to run both better.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think these like Grand Slams and bigger tournaments, their goal is to make money. And I think one of the issues in that article when they talked about the year that Wimbledon banned Russian and Belarusian players and the ATP and WTA tour said, okay, well, we're not going to give any ranking points, but players still went and played. Yep. And play like the tournament still made money. And I think that ended up punishing the players, A, that weren't there, and also the ones that were there, because there were players that made huge runs and it didn't end up counting for anything in the rankings and didn't really help them, because it's not like, like in tennis, you have to defend your points from each tournament depending on like how far you made it every year. And that affects your ranking as well. That affects how much money you're able to make. So I just think it's a little bit odd when the tours have like their idea of disciplining tournaments, but the tournaments don't really care. So then it's like, okay, well, how much do the rankings actually matter? And then is this also in turn affecting the players that are trying to get onto the professional tour? Like that to me is the biggest thing. Like from that article, they said that the solution with the smaller tournaments would be to turn it into kind of a the developmental league. And that's why the Premier League would just be like the top players and the biggest ones. And then you work your way up. But my question with that is like, how do you determine who the top players are? Because ranking numbers are so situational. Like you take Alina Svitolina, who she was one of the top players in the world. She has a baby. She has that protected ranking because of the maternity leave. But she comes back, she wins something. She's at the level she was. But then how do you decide? Does she play the smaller tournaments when she comes back, or is she allowed to play in the Premier League? Like it's those kind of things where you're like, how do you decide that? Serena Williams, before she retired, she was out for over a year with the injury, but she was given special wild cards into tournaments because she's Serena Williams, of course, like the greatest of all time. Of course, she was granted all these wild cards to play in tournaments that normally, if your ranking had fallen that far, you'd have to play in qualifying to get into the tournament. So it's just like, they'd have to play God almost, which is already kind of happening. And I just fear that like, it's just going to become worse because of how situational every single player is.
Yeah. My takeaway from this story is that from literally the first, like, one of the first jobs I ever had, I worked at, like, a Kmart when I was, like, in high school. And I learned at that job that, like, I loved all my coworkers and, like, management was a disaster. And, like, every job I've had since then has basically followed that same formula. And now we can talk about, like, any professional sport. And it's essentially the same thing where, like, I love the workers, but, like, if the people at the top could just get out of the way. So, Karina, I want to thank you for this terrifying insight into the reality of professional tennis in 2024.
Good. Yeah. Maybe the solution is a union. I don't know how they go about doing that, but it could be a step.
Have the players always, as far as you know, operated as independent contractors?
Yeah, they've been independent contractors. I can't remember if, like, maybe when Billie Jean King was doing, like, her work with, like, getting women into the game and equal pay. I'm not sure maybe what kind of structure there was then. I'd have to do a little bit more research into that. But, like, as far as I can remember, tennis players have been independent contractors for, like, the entire time that I've known the sport.
Well, the Jackman Sports Show has a definite opinion about whether or not joining a union would be beneficial for the tennis players, and we would certainly encourage them to do so. Hopefully one day we will have you back on the show to talk about unionization in the world of tennis. Karina, we can find you on Twitter at KarinaMM. Is there anywhere else right now besides Twitter and your Coast to Coast pod that people should look out for your voice or your words or anything of interest?
Yeah, like I said, I'm starting an internship with Canada Basketball. It's a communications internship, so I'm going to be involved in social media and writing stories. So make sure you're following Canada Basketball on all social media. That's the handle, at Canada Basketball. And you can look out for my stuff in the new year for them.
Awesome. Thank you for letting us all know all of that. Also, good luck with your semester. And
thank you.
We will talk to you again in the future. Peace.